Hello and welcome to the Health First Talks podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Baumuni, and today we are talking about anaphylaxis. So first off, thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate your time.
No problem.
Thank you.
If we can, just having you give us a brief bio before we get into the question and answers. Dr. Brady, starting with you.
Absolutely. I'm Dr. Jason Brady. I'm from Gilbert, Arizona. I'm a dentist anesthesiologist. I'm in private practice, and I'm also associate program director for NYU Langone. We're all into education, so we're very happy to be here today.
Hello, I'm Dr. Amanda Okundaye. I'm a dentist anesthesiologist based in Las Vegas, Nevada. I have a mobile practice as well as being the associate program director at UNLV Dental Anesthesiology Residency. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
Happy to have you both here. So let's start off here with defining anaphylaxis. What is it and how does it present itself?
Well, anaphylaxis can be defined as some people would say something as simple as a bad allergy. So you have mild, which would be an allergic response, and then you have something major, which is anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis truly is a whole body immune response, whereas we say in anesthesia, everything's circling the drain. So you see airway issues, you see a release of histamine, right? Leukotrienes, all of these things, if we're getting into the physiology of this. And patients can have many different triggers to anaphylaxis that in dentistry or medicine, it can be antibiotics, it can be latex, it can be insect venom, it could be peanuts. So there's many different triggers for anaphylaxis, but truly is just considered a major allergy.
And sometimes too, it's not even the first exposure that causes anaphylaxis.
Correct.
So you may not even know that it's coming because you've had exposures to this before. Mm-hmm. And you may not have had that type of reaction.
Absolutely.
So with all of that in mind, what would you say is the biggest mistake that clinicians make with anaphylaxis?
I think it's hesitation. You know, when you have to do something and act on a crisis event, the first step is always the most important. And when you hesitate with anaphylaxis, your airway is starting to be compromised because all that swelling and that edema is closing up literally that patient's airway.
Yes, as Jason said, it really is the most one of the most time sensitive medical emergencies that we see, and you really don't have time. You have to predict what's happening and not hesitate and move forward fairly quickly with whatever medical emergency intervention there is.
What is then the first line of intervention?
The first line of intervention for anaphylaxis is epinephrine. We want to stabilize those mast cells because that is what's causing a lot of these histamine release, the prostaglandins, and the leukotrienes. So epinephrine is going to be your first line of offense when you have an anaphylactic reaction.
And to piggyback off that, epinephrine is your first line drug. It's given intramuscularly with an auto-injector or another source of epinephrine. But that drug is your only first-line drug. It's not antihistamines. It's not steroids. It's epinephrine intramuscularly given in the upper thigh or the vastus lateralis.
I want to ask you about biphasic anaphylaxis. What do people need to know about that? And then how often can that happen?
So biphasic anaphylaxis is where you think that the issue is resolved. And that resolved is not there because afterwards you could have another reaction. And sometimes those are very delayed. Usually 8 to 11 hours afterwards, you can have another issue with anaphylaxis where you have a lot of symptoms such as swelling, mast itching, and also hypotension. So there's a lot of things that could happen afterwards that are very critical to manage.
I also, just to piggyback off that, would say that I think it surprises a lot of clinicians that people can assume they treated it, it's done, and they've moved on. But physiologically, things are still happening. And that could be without more exposure to whatever the trigger was. And I think that's something really important to point out, is that even without having more of that trigger that caused the anaphylaxis in the first place, you can still have symptoms later on, as Jason said, 8 to 12 hours after that exposure.
And as a follow-up to that, is there a way to predict who is going to bounce back from anaphylaxis or have that experience?
I would say not reliably. There are many risk features that we can't predict. We have no idea. All we can do is observe the patient and give that first dose of that epinephrine. And that's why we say anaphylaxis is truly not a single event. It is a process physiologically.
And a lot of people get themselves in trouble with that because if you don't have that understanding, you think all is well and you can send your patient home. And then they're in a home environment with no healthcare provider, and then they run into a crisis event.
Absolutely.
And we know with anaphylaxis, time is crucial. It is not your friend.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned timing, and I want to talk about that. What are we looking at? Just how crucial is that timing? Can you maybe break it down for us?
I think that initially your presentation can look very mild. If it's just hives rash, you assume mild allergy, not major anaphylaxis. And when you're going down an algorithm of how to treat this, I think that clinicians would be first to reach for antihistamines, thinking it's just an allergic reaction. More fear for giving epinephrine too soon, too early, but really that's not what they're comfortable with. So I would say it's, you know, early presentation can look mild. And so it does delay people giving epinephrine. Hopefully that answers that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, when you're called to action, it's easy to give a little bit of medicine intravenously than having a big auto injector that's hit in someone's thigh. A lot of times as dentists, we can do injections intraorally and we're very comfortable with that.
Right.
But we're very uncomfortable with giving injections around the body. And I know a lot of our physicians are exactly opposite of that. And so we know what we know and we do what we do and we're very comfortable with it. And I think that's the hesitation part that plays into that human factor.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would also, since we're still on epinephrine, like to say that I think the biggest risk when it comes to anaphylaxis and treating anaphylaxis would be the word undertreatment. Not reaching for that epinephrine early enough would be undertreatment, right? And so that hesitation, as Jason said earlier, really is where that comes into play.
And really, epinephrine is the only early thing that we can do for interventions to reduce morbidity and mortality.
Absolutely.
And why are two doses needed in some cases?
Because as Jason said earlier, progression is unpredictable, right? We have no idea, honestly, what's happening physiologically other than by symptoms, looking at blood pressure, looking at airway. We don't really know if these persistent symptoms or poor initial response to epinephrine really did the trick, right? So because recurrence is an issue, you must be prepared to treat those sequelae of more symptoms.
You're way better off being prepared and have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And really, it's one of these things that you have to have to be prepared for it because you just never know. At least 20% of the population is going to have some reflactic type of situation. And there's a big time window when we don't know when that is actually going to occur. And it brings up another point, too, where people have to understand if it is truly anaphylaxis and that's what you think your differential diagnosis is, they need to be observed.
Mm-hmm.
Got to be time with it.
To piggyback off that, I think that's such a great point because also most state boards, and I say most because I haven't read every single one of them, say you need to have multiple doses of epinephrine. They're not saying that so that you have to spend, you know, exponential amount of money on epinephrine auto-injectors. They're saying that because it's very clear in national data that patients may need a second dose of epinephrine. And so in real world setting, a second dose may be needed before EMS shows up to your dental practice or before EMS, you know, takes you to the ER, whatever that is, that's where that comes into play.
And you know, it makes me think of another human factor that we have too. We're very hesitant to transport to higher levels of care, to go to the hospital. You know, we have to have that observation window. And in a dental office, you don't want to manage this in a dental office. It needs to be where someone and you have the resources to take care of it quickly. That human factor of hesitation is because many states require you to report if you have a transport of a patient.
Absolutely.
And then they are in fear of their license or in fear of their permit. Mm-hmm. So it is one of these barriers that we need to get over within our community as well.
Yeah, great point.
And of course, observation is where practice can vary significantly. So who is at highest risk from needing that second dose?
Well, just like we've talked about, it's a huge range of when that biphasic event could happen. And so the highest risk people are the ones that have more severe initial presentation. If something happens very quickly, you're deteriorating very, very fastly. That is a rapid onset type of situation. They are the ones that are more predictably going to have a biphasic event versus someone with a little bit of itchy and rashiness. That's a slow progression. Usually those are a little tamer type of situations. But if you see the vitals that are going swirling down the tank, so to speak, those are the ones that are at the highest risk, and especially for the delay of the first dose of epinephrine, because that is the only thing that's going to prevent the airway from closing up and losing a patent airway.
And as Jason said, what basically prediction is imperfect. So if a patient is unstable from a physiologic standpoint, they have hypotension, cardiovascular instability, they're now having wheezing and they're having other symptoms, we know that our prediction is imperfect. So they really do need within that 24 hours to be observed in case they do have this biphasic anaphylaxis.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll share a story with you. I had an anaphylactic event that happened in the hospital. And what this was a person that was allergic to shellfish at a seafood restaurant. Something got cross-contaminated. He knew about it, and he had a reaction, a very severe reaction, and he had an EpiPen that he treated with himself. And he didn't want to go to the hospital. He felt like everything was working just fine. He actually went home, and by the time he had that biphasic event and he had anaphylactic shock, going back into it again at the house. Once he got to the hospital, his airway was closing down very rapidly. In fact, they were almost about to do a cricothyrotomy on this patient. That's how severe and how quickly this happened.
Mm-hmm. And when he got to the hospital, what happened?
So once he got to the hospital, we had to do a blind nasal intubation. We couldn't even scope because the tissues were touching each other. We couldn't even get to that point. Thankfully, we were able to do a blind nasal intubation. And once he was also intubated, people kind of left their guard down. Even the physicians that were there, they all left. And what we noticed afterwards is severe hypotension and bradycardia and other cardiovascular events that go along with it. So we had to do an epinephrine infusion, and we had to do something that's called an A-line. The pressures were so sensitive that we had to catheterize the artery to be able to get real-time blood pressures on this patient to manage. So you're not going to be able to manage this appropriately in a dental office. It really needs to be in a hospital setting.
I think that's the point, is that with biphasic anaphylaxis, you can assume that something's okay. Later, it can turn into a huge hospitalization emergency, and that's in many different settings.
And of course, situation that can escalate very quickly. Carrying two EpiPens with me myself because of a tree nut allergy, I know how fast things can move. Fortunately, never had that experience. And I'm so glad we're having this conversation so that that information can be put out there so people know how this can turn very seriously, very quickly. I mean, you're literally talking about the difference between life and death. So as we wrap up here, first off, I thank you for all the information that you've already given us. But any final thoughts that you would like to leave the audience with before we close it out?
Sure. I have a few other thoughts as well. One of the things that we talk about, being quick to react and actually knowing what to do. Under stress, even if we practice these things, our mind tends to shrink. There are really good doctors that can just have a bad day because it's something that we're not practicing or very familiar with all the time. It's just human nature for that. And when we get scared to do something, it's hard to take that very first step. But taking that very first step is the most critical part, and it really helps out. And that's why I'm really glad that we have auto-injectors like the AviQ that actually will talk to you and lead you down and tell you what those first steps is. Because even though we may know it, we may practice it, until we're challenged with it, we don't realize the implications of ourselves and the stress that's there. And having something simply to remind us to do something is a big step in making that first step.
Absolutely. And that's the same thing with Health First, right? In your kits, you get an AviQ. One of the nicest things about that AviQ, it is a simulated emergency response. It tells you what to do. And, we're moving towards that, right? The AED tells you what to do. It's been 2 minutes. Same thing with the epinephrine for anaphylaxis. It says, remove this, hold to the patient's thigh. you know, count 1-1,000, 2-1,000. It takes the human behavior out of it, of having an error, because under stress, we freeze. We overthink, you know, on a podcast, we overthink, we freeze. But the same thing happens in an emergency. And when we fumble, it's life or death, as you said. So, you know, we don't want to fumble when it's something that we can be prepared for and have multiple doses of and have good recognition. And I think that's part of this podcast. It's having the familiarity before an emergency happens and understanding that there's a reason why we're saying there's a reason why you need to have two doses of epinephrine, but that mental in the back of your head, like, I'm grabbing a single dose of epinephrine, let me wait 3 to 5 minutes and see that everything's okay, call EMS, do all the things they need to do, but having in the back of their mind that a second dose may be absolutely necessary in about 20% of the population. This can be one of those patients in my chair now. I think will really lend itself to have better outcomes and less, you know, poor hospitalizations, as your patient did, than not knowing this or not watching this podcast. So carrying two doses and being prepared, I think, is absolutely very important.
Actually, there's a great video that we're going to share within the link that shows what anaphylaxis looks like and how quickly epinephrine takes place. So when you watch this video, what I want you to appreciate is that she takes the auto-injector, administers herself, and you see how severe the anaphylactic is with her wheezing and how quickly it's resolved.
So if people had any questions or they wanted to reach out to either of you, any places you can send them?
Personally, they can email me. Mine is ddsanesthesia@gmail.com. They can also look for information by sending an email to info@sedationacademy.org and ask any questions they have of their professionals.
Thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate your time, and obviously very important topic here today. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening to the Health First Talks podcast. Of course, if you'd like to catch more conversations like the one you heard today, definitely a learning experience and information that needs to be put out there, we would encourage you to subscribe to the podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Dawn Mooney. Thanks again for joining us. We hope to connect with you on another podcast soon.